This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from, well, from glorious Clearwater, St. Petersburg area, and I'm saying St. Petersburg today because I have the former First Lady of St. Petersburg is going to be on the program at the end of, bottom of the hour. But, so I want to make sure that I throw St. Petersburg in there because it is beautiful here and it is glorious. But now I get to turn to somebody whose book is set in New York, a city, which I love because he keeps describing all the places that I used to walk around in New York City. So I'm happy to welcome award-winning author Mark Rubenstein. And the name of his new book is Assassin's Lullaby. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Okay, great. Well, I had so much fun reading this book, partly because you were you mentioned streets and in the old days, you know, when one could go to New York, one walked around a lot. So I enjoyed that so much.
Well, you know, it's the setting for the novel, and some of the highlights take place in or around Grand Central Terminal and other locales, Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, and various side streets in Manhattan.
Yeah, I love it. I felt like I was running, well, not walking, actually, usually running. this is a very exciting book. You have had such a absolutely tremendous release here, because so many authors have such wonderful things to say about you, and so many of the authors who say these wonderful things, like James Rollins, he was just on the program a few weeks ago, and he writes he gave you such a wonderful blurb. I like that he said relentlessly paced, and he knows his business too, and so it was great that he wrote that. And I loved what I particularly loved what which one? Lisa Gardner. I liked what Lisa Gardner wrote about you. So, you know, it's just wonderful when you can get these kind of blurbs from people.
Well, these are people who are obviously well known in the writing field, and you know, I've always been surprised how generous and giving so many thriller authors are. Lisa Gardner is certainly one of them. So is James Rollins, Harlan Coben, and a whole variety of others. But some people are reluctant to give out blurbs. Others give them out very freely. One of the biggest blurbers I know of is Lee Child.
Oh, yes. And he, you know, he's been on the program many times, and he comes on for a one-hour program for his birthday every year. So we talk a lot about, you know, he's like me. He reads a lot. I can read so much. I've been reading since I was 3 years old, and so I read a lot. But I love, actually, when a book like this, where you're naming streets, and it's also for me when people write books like set in Paris or London, wherever I've lived, and they're naming the streets, so I can visualize it. I love it.
But, you know, one of the things in writing a novel is to take the reader to a place that the reader feels is either universal, you know, I've felt that, I've thought that, or a place that the reader has been to. And that's fairly easy when you're writing a novel that's set in New York City, because so many people have been to New York City, particularly Manhattan and some of the areas in the Midtown section.
Now, you know, it's always difficult with me. I don't like to know anything about a book before I start reading it, other than, you know, I will look at the cover, but I normally will not even look at the author's photo on the back. I don't look at anything. I just want the surprise that comes along with the reading. A writer's worked so hard to build in all of this suspense and getting people all ready for action and thrills. And so often nowadays, you know, because they write things in these blurbs on online, you know, bookstores, that they give away everything, so you know what's going to happen. And I don't like that, because you have some really twists and turns here that, you know, I'm not sure how much you want to tell people about your main character.
Well, I would say is that Eli Dagan is a character who was a former Mossad operative with a very tragic and checkered past, and he finds himself seeking redemption in a way, and it's not certain that he's going to find that redemption. He's contacted by a Russian mob boss and asked to do a couple of jobs because he's basically a contract killer, and he is that because of his tragic past and what it did to him. And that's where the action and the thrills and the mystery and the suspense begins. And you're right. You don't want to give away... The essence of thrillers is for the reader to say, oh my God, what happens next?
Exactly. I love that. I love the reveal.
Yeah, the reveal and the twist and, oh, I wasn't expecting that, or, oh boy, where did that... And then you look back and say, oh, I see exactly where that came from, and I could tell that the author was hinting at that, but never revealed it until I found it myself. So I fully understand your reluctance to get into too many details about a thriller novel, because that would really take away the joy of reading for the listener.
Exactly. Well, that's why when you do have a blurb from somebody like Lisa Gardner or anybody, one of these famous ones, Joseph Finder, if they say it's good, then it's good, and you can really trust them, because they're readers who get the point. They get, you know, the concept, and they know what will make a reader turn the pages, and that's what they want with you. They want everybody to. I tell you, it's beautiful to see this kind of reaction, because, as I said, most of these people who have given you blurbs have been on the program, and I also trust them so much, because like Reed Farrell Coleman. He is a terrific writer, and
oh,
so
definitely, yeah.
Oh, isn't he? He's wonderful, and he knows his stuff. And so when he says it's good, it's good.
Yeah, well, Reed is he's a master stylist. He's called the poet laureate of noir, and he really is. When you read some of his books, you get the feeling that you're reading a beautifully written, almost literary noir novel.
So what is your, nowadays, I don't know what the, you know, how people are releasing books. Before, you would have been attending conventions, perhaps the International Thriller Convention. What's happening from the promotion side with you with this new book?
Well, here I am on your radio show, and there are others that have been lined up. And I was on one at 8 o'clock this morning. There are, of course, all the blog tours, and there will be library appearances in the local area where I live. And these days, of course, so much is done on Zoom. So you know,
it's not as much fun.
It's not as much fun, but in a way, it's a lot easier. You know, there's a lot less traveling. I have one scheduled on Thursday, which is going to be for a full hour, and it's a Zoom, so I have to shave, you know.
Well, you know, but you still don't get to hang around the bar after everything.
That's true.
And that's the most fun. And I had so much fun at BoucherCon in Dallas. Well, now it's a few years ago. It's so hard to believe. It's been a crazy time, hasn't it? When did you start writing this book?
I think I began writing it about a year ago, although I interspersed it with writing something else, so, and then I went back to this. So it's hard to really pinpoint down. it's funny. On some days you can write 2,000 words. Other days you struggle to get through 300. So in a way, the time seems sort of juggled, and it's difficult to put a linear label on it. But I think it took about a year because, you know, I've always believed that writing is basically rewriting. And when you go through the rewrites and the revisions, I sort of lose track of time. But I would say the total was probably close to a year.
So you had a little bit during the lockdown.
Yes. In a way, for a writer, the lockdown was almost a kind of bonus in a way. I mean, you really couldn't go out and do much of anything anyway. So you sat and either at your computer or your laptop or whatever, and you did what you do. But, you know.
Yeah. it had its benefits for some writers. And I just spoke to a writer who wrote 3 books during the time.
Yeah.
But, you know. I wanted to ask you particularly one sentence in your book. I love when I come across something that I haven't read before. Like every once in a while, recently, C.J. Box had written about somebody having Alcoa hair, you know, which is very descriptive, you know.
Yes.
And in your book, you wrote a sentence called This is after he's running around. you're pronouncing it Eli, right?
Eli, yeah.
Yeah. I lived in Israel for many years, so I say Eli. So throughout, as I'm reading it, to me it's Eli. Uh-huh. And so, but yes, Eli is running around and escaping and stuff. And then he gets to a place, and I'll read the sentence. He stutter steps, whirls, moves ahead, gets to the far side of Lexington. Stutter steps, that's the first time I've seen it.
Oh, really? Well, stutter step is something that I think people do in football and in basketball. You know?
Well, see, I probably it's in football or basketball books, and I never came across it, so I love it.
Uh-huh.
I love it. I thought, oh, that's so cool. I like that.
You know, reading any novel in any genre is really, hopefully, it's an act of discovery for the reader. So it's wonderful to hear that you discovered something.
Yeah, I mean that gave me such a thrill. I like that. Well, just actually thinking about you gives me a bit of a thrill because I'm wondering what you were doing or if you remember a certain date in history. You know, you're a writer, you're a doctor, by the way, I should tell people. I mean, we could talk all about what, I mean, you're so accomplished. But I think you might remember this date. And if you do, I will be very happy. October 4th, 1955. Where were you?
Oh, my God. October 4th, 1965.
55. You were young.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was just a boy.
Yeah. Do you remember that date?
No, I don't. I don't remember what I was doing on that date.
Well, that's the day the Brooklyn Dodgers won the World Series.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Okay. You took me into a whole other realm of existence.
That's right. It's a long time ago. But why do I know that? Well, because I'm a Detroit Tigers fan.
Uh-huh.
And my father used to take me from the time before I could walk, actually, we went to every Tigers game. But he always loved the Dodgers.
Uh-huh.
If he had, you know, a second team to follow, it was always the Brooklyn Dodgers. And, when they left Brooklyn, he never, well, I still call them Brooklyn Dodgers. I can't call them those other name. But he always loved the Dodgers, and we actually got to meet Sandy Koufax once in synagogue, and he kissed me. Of course, I was a little girl then, but I remember that about the Dodgers.
Yeah, well, I was a Dodger fan, and my hero was Gil Hodges because I thought he was just a wonderful ball player and a great human being. And he lived in Brooklyn, as did most of them in those days. They, you know, these were not the days of multi million-dollar contracts. These guys all, they were working class guys who took the subway to Ebbets Field every day.
So, but you did go to a lot of games?
Oh, I went to games. Oh, yes. We used to pay $1.25 general admission, and then we'd sneak down to the box seats.
Oh, wow. Those were the days. It always gives me a kick to talk to somebody who was actually lived in Brooklyn. We did have a few relatives who lived in Brooklyn, and especially somebody who got to go to the Brooklyn Dodgers games exactly the way you did. I didn't have to sneak in because my dad was a Teamster, and we used to get tickets right behind first base, which is my favorite spot, because in those days, there was a lot of stealing of bases. They don't steal bases so much nowadays.
Well, I think the technology is such that pitchers have really mastered the art of delivering the ball in a much quicker way than they used to. And you remember the old days, they used to do a big wind up on the mound, but they don't do that anymore.
No, it's not.
It's tougher.
Yeah, it's.
But a good portion of this novel takes place in Brooklyn, by the way.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Tapping on some of my own personal background in that. I used to live right near Brighton Beach, which is where the Brighton Beach Mafia, or otherwise known as the Odessa Mafia, is located. And that, too, plays an integral part in the book.
It certainly does. And I enjoyed that excursion into Brooklyn because I do. Whenever I think of my dad, I think of baseball because that's what we did. In those days, they had games during the day. The weekday, it was so much fun in those days to go to a baseball game.
They also had double headers where you only had to pay once and you could see two games.
Oh yeah, we did that much to my mother's consternation because she where's Patsy? I spent a lot of time over there, so. Well, I think that, you're such a fine writer, and I think you've had fun writing this book.
Oh, I did. I had a great deal of fun. Part of it was also learning what I did have to learn about the Odessa Mafia and about the Mossad and about various intelligence operations and various scenarios by which people could kill one another. It sounds morbid, but it was a great deal of fun doing the research for this novel. And as much as you try and get readers to discover and learn things by reading, by creating, you also end up doing a good deal of research and learning yourself about things that you never thought you'd even be interested in.
So did you take up Krav Maga?
I wish I could, but I'm a little old for that now. But Krav Maga also is featured in the novel. It's an Israeli self-defense.
I know. I was married to my husband's Israeli, and I also lived in Israel for many years, and I'm a kickboxer.
Oh.
So, and Krav Maga, too, but kickboxing was what I've always loved. As a matter of fact, right now I'm suffering from a little bit of an injury. But, so I found that interesting. So you did some research into that? Did you get to go and have people show you a little sample of it?
Well, here's where technology is so ubiquitous these days. Rather than doing that, all I did was go on YouTube and I watched, I can't even remember how many videos I watched of people doing Krav Maga, teaching it, demonstrating it, and I can't in any way say I'm an expert even in describing it, I certainly got a good taste and feel for it by watching all these videos, and it seems to me to be a very effective self-defense protocol, and that's just one of the many things that I had to learn. I had to look up certain weapons and guns and methods of doing away with bad people. And
you came up with a few clever ideas, I can tell you. I enjoyed it. Let's put it that way.
Part of the thing is, I came away with the notion, never smoke a cigar where you don't know its provenance.
Well, there's lots of things you don't want to do. I want to tell people that they will enjoy this part of where they have these twists and these turns and it's just a lot of fun. So do you do your own Facebook? Do you Facebook?
I don't do any Facebook. I do a lot of Twitter, but not Facebook. I find if I spend too much time on social media, I'm going to end up not writing. So I limit myself to Twitter.
Yeah, that's true. But I was wondering if you hashtagged Mossad when you do Facebook. I was so surprised that the Mossad has a hashtag and a Facebook page.
Really?
Oh yeah.
I didn't know that.
so you can go right there and when you're promoting the book, you can put hashtag Mossad and it goes.
Uh-huh.
It's so funny. I was actually surprised. I looked into that yesterday because I said, I wonder, because I was I'm trying to promote the book and find more, a bigger audience for you. And I like always to, expand horizons. So I send postings to book lovers and thriller lovers and all of this. And then it suddenly occurred to me, if somebody's in the Air Force, I always, hashtag the Air Force. And then I suddenly realized, what about the Mossad? I mean, people in... And so I looked and I was so shocked. Yes, they have a Facebook page. And yes, I can hashtag them. So isn't it cute?
Yes. The bottom line is that the Mossad is everywhere.
Yeah. Well, that's true. But so I got a kick out of that. So I'm sure now a lot of them are also having fun. Is the book going to be translated into Hebrew? Turn up in Israel?
I have no idea. It depends on what the publisher, can do, or who knows. once the book is out and it's on a shelf, it's completely out of my hands, and you have to give it over. It's like any work of art, or any craft. Once the labor is done, and once you've the creation has been created, it's out of the creator's hands, and wherever it goes, I don't have much control over that.
Well, I think that it's always so much fun to talk to somebody who has found this joy on paper that you have over the years. I actually have to have you back on because I want to mention that you're deeply involved in sort of the in this book too, I suppose, the psychology of crime.
Yeah, the psychology. Actually, it's not just the psychology of crime; it's the psychology of conflict. The essence, I think, of any good story is that the protagonist is in a situation of conflict, that there's a protagonist and an antagonist, and that there's a conflict between people, among people, and also there's conflict within the protagonist himself or herself. And I think the conflict lends... Well, I'll give you the old... I was once talking with David Mamet because I used to interview authors on the Huffington Post, and he agreed with me that conflict is the essence of really all drama. And he said, if Hamlet comes home from school one day and his father says, "How was school?" and he says, "It was great, Dad," that's boring. But if Hamlet believes that his uncle killed his father and is sleeping with his mother, well, there's conflict. And it becomes interesting.
As I'm talking to you and I'm thinking about your other books and about this whole psychology of conflict, I realize I want you to come back also because you have a beautiful voice for radio. So will you come back and we'll have a half an hour talking about just about the art of writing and some of your interviews that you've done and some of the people that you've spoken to, and helping, because I have so many people who are just starting to write who are looking for advice. So will you come back for a half an hour?
I certainly will. I'd love to.
Okay. Well, I will contact your people. Your people will contact my people. And we have people. And okay. Isn't it nice? And anyway, I want to just thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. The name of the book is Mark Rubenstein. Did you say Rubenstein?
Rubenstein. Yes.
Yeah, I hope so. We have all, you know, if we have Levines, in my synagogue, it drives me crazy. Assassin's Lullaby, a great title. I like the cover, too. And I know your website is markrubenstein-author, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so people, you can look for him on his website. It's a nice website, and also social media. And wherever books are sold, online and in fine bookstores, you'll find Assassin's Lullaby by Mark Rubenstein. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on, Patsy. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, we're going to have you back soon, okay?
Okay, sure.
Great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're going to do a few commercials, just commercials, and then I come back with my guest.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper the former First Lady of St. Petersburg, Florida. Doesn't that sound nice? First Lady? First Lady of St. Petersburg, Carrie Kreisman. Hi.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. It's so wonderful to talk to you.
And you as well. I'm happy to be here.
Actually, I was thinking about it, and I think I have shaken your hand a couple of times at different functions a long time ago. this is back. When you were in office from when to when? From 20?
My, hus- uh, My husband was in office for 22 years, first as a city council member in St. Petersburg, then as a state house rep for 6 years, and most recently as St. Petersburg's mayor from 2014 to 2022.
So, yeah, I was meeting people around 2014, 2015, and then I started the radio program, and after that, I'm, you know, so busy with the program that I haven't didn't do too many social events.
Right.
Wow.
I totally understand that.
This is so exciting because I love just even saying First Lady and knowing that you were the First Lady here in the town, you know, near where I live. And St. Petersburg is such a gorgeous place. If you're going to be a First Lady of any place, that, you know, that's pretty great.
Yeah, so we are lucky to call St. Pete home. And being a native, I've seen so many places through the years, and it's only gotten better. And no place we'd rather live in the state of Florida than right here in St. Pete.
You're cutting, the phone's cutting out a little bit. Can you either hold it closer or something?
Yes, hold on one sec.
Yeah, the sound, I don't want to lose you.
Is that better?
Yes, that's better.
Is that better? Okay.
That's better. Okay, because I want you to tell us your story. I want to tell people that Carrie is on today to talk about her first book, Accidental First Lady, On the Front Lines. It's nonfiction, but as I was reading this book, I kept thinking to myself, well, when is Carrie coming back? Because I know now that she has found the joy of writing, she's going to be writing a novel, right?
I don't know yet. I'm not sure.
I bet. I bet. Anybody who can write as well as you do. And with, you know what I love about it? You take us right into things, into your life, into your family, into your all of the different events that you took part in. And one of my favorite was that you talked about your little brother. I just, I got a kick out of that. So you see, that's what a great writer does, really makes you jump into that story. So you tell us about yourself, about, you know, you start off the book telling, really, that you were a born writer, practically, because you wrote something at the age of 8, which is pretty impressive.
Well, sometimes I think you don't realize what direction your life is going to go in, and then when you look back on your life, you think, were there signs, or was I meant to be, you know, did I finally end up where I was supposed to be through a series of different paths to get me there? You know, we never envisioned political life when my husband and I first met. It wasn't like our first date or even before our marriage. He said, someday I want to be the mayor of St. Petersburg. It's just kind of like many of our lives. It ebbed and flowed, and we just took each challenge as it came and made decisions as they were presented to us and, you know, capitalized on opportunities if we felt it was a good move. And, you know, I never, he was far into his political career before I ever even thought about writing about my part of it and what it meant to be a political spouse. And so you know, you just never know where life is going to take you. And so it's just been fun. And I'm happy that someone asked me about my stories and wanted to know more and that people are enjoying the book.
Well, you, as I said, you're an excellent writer because when you wrote about your brother and you you mentioned that he was voted most humorous. The most humorous, yeah. And that's my younger brother would be voted the same thing. So I got a kick out of that. And much like you, I was, you know, more serious and so when you are able to relate to your reader in this way, mm-hmm. you've got talent.
Well, thank you. And I wanted it to be that way. I mean, when you write nonfiction, you have to grapple with telling the truth. I mean, you know, if you don't want to tell the truth or tell your story, you write fiction, and that's both are wonderful. But, you know, it was a balance between you know, telling the truth and sharing as much of my life that I felt comfortable with and being honest with whoever was going to read this and honest with myself.
Well,
that's the only way to do it.
I think you also give a nice insight into what life was like in St. Petersburg years ago.
Right.
But let's get back to that first thing that you wrote at the age of 8 that was published.
Okay. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I don't know how long you've been in the area, but this area, St. Pete, used to have two newspapers, as I say, date in my book, the St. Petersburg Times, which is now the Tampa Bay Times, and then the Evening Independent. And, you know, you get that between 4 and 5 o'clock every afternoon on your doorstep if you were a subscriber. And back then, I think everybody was. So, yes, my great aunt, who we used to stay with on the weekends, challenged me to do this exercise. And I did. I wrote, and I, you know, as a kid, I forgot about it. And then next thing you know, she shows me, and I printed right there in the paper. And it was, you know, no more than a paragraph, but at the age of 8, to see something you wrote printed in your hometown paper was pretty cool. And somehow it survived all these years, you know, through different moves and, you know, even a house fire that miraculously some things were saved. But so, yeah, I still have that clipping.
And so what did you write that's so, it was like beshert, it was meant to be?
Yeah, well, at the time, this columnist, Jim Moorhead, and many people in the area will know him and remember him. He was very revered and just around for a long time. And so every Saturday, he posed a question that was like, and it was different. And so this question happened to be, if you could go anywhere in the world or on any trip or something like that, where would you want to go and why? So my aunt put the paper and pencil in front of me and asked me to think about that and decide what I wanted to say. And at that time, I had not yet been to Washington, D.C. I didn't realize that a year and a half later, I'd be going there for a family vacation, but at the time, I said I wanted to go to Washington, D.C. and shake hands with the president. So, you know, fast forward to 40 years later, possibly, we've had that opportunity, and I never imagined writing that at age 8. You know, I'd be shaking hands with you know, maybe a couple presidents.
Yeah.
I think I've met a couple, but It was really something, so it's fun to look back on that.
Well, I think this book is really wonderful. I like the behind the scenes of everything, you know, all books, but particularly political things, because my first job was actually with a very famous person in politics who is still in Congress, and it was my first actual job, and I got at the age of 18 I got a behind the scenes look, and since then I've been interested. And so
wow.
But now when you were writing this book, I mean, part of the thing is, you tell us, well, let's start, you know, because we don't have that much time, the day that Rick became the mayor of St. Petersburg. There had been a lot of buildup there. He's a lawyer, went to Stetson University here, which is, of course, a great law school. And so he had all this. And what was that day like for you? To win that election.
Do you mean election day?
Yeah, election day.
Or election day. Well, you know, when you're in the throes of an election, and at that time that was his biggest election ever, you are just, you're getting to the end. You can't think past the end. And every day, that's the longest day, and election day, everyone will tell you, I think, if they're very close to a campaign, whether you're the candidate or you're part of the family or you're on the staff or a really invested volunteer, it is the longest day. It starts early at 7 a.m. We voted shortly after the polls opened, and it doesn't end till after the polls close. And you just move from moment to moment, and it moved at a snail's pace. So for me, you know, we went and voted, and I accompanied Rick to a coffee shop, and then, you know, I went home and cleaned the house. I mean, it was kind of methodical to do because I didn't work that day. I just stayed home and then, you know, went and got my son at school, and I don't remember. I don't think my daughter was driving, so I picked her up, but we just moved through the motions, and then we were told to be somewhere, you know, to check into a hotel at a certain time and then to be at the party venue. And it was going to be a party regardless. It was either a victory party or a thank you party for everyone, depending on the outcome. And then it was just, you know, once we got there, and in this particular case, the polls showed and the early voting returns were back early enough to show that he had a big enough margin that no matter what happened on the turnout day, that he was going to win. So it was the mail-in voting that was back so early that they could determine. But yet they didn't tell him that or us because they didn't want my husband to let up on the gas and stop working hard, which he didn't. He never does. He works till the last possible moment. And so when we showed up, it was a quick congratulations and the champagne and just the, you know, hundreds of people. And it was a whirlwind. It was a really fun evening. We got maybe 2 to 3 hours of sleep, and he was up dressed in a suit by 7 a.m. the next morning, fielding interviews, and I was taking my kids to school just like any other day. And then I walked into work and, you know, to a decorated office with congratulations and all that. So it was really something. It was a whirlwind. It was exciting. It was, you know, lots of congratulatory text messages. It was the beginning of a new phase, one that lasted 8 years that we were privileged. He was privileged to have it and to be reelected a second time. And as a family and as his spouse, I was privileged to just be a part of all of this and you know, see the politics from that side and see aspects of our city and the people who live here and care so much about it. You know, it was really an education.
Well, you were involved in that those 8 years. Many things happened here in St. Petersburg.
Exactly.
So we had, I mean, I think, what were some of the more dramatic things that happened during your term?
During his term? Well,
your term, too, because you're the first lady.
Well, the profile of St. Pete was raised tremendously. I mean, as he came in, St. Pete was on the cusp. I mean, the arts community and entrepreneurs and small business people had already been working and building and, you know, investing in St. Pete, and it was on the cusp of greatness. And so some of the most significant things that happened were, you know, the descendant of small business or descendants and influx of small businesses that... And that's what made St. Pete unique. And it's not any one business or any one industry, but our arts were elevated to an even higher level. We've had anchors such as the Dolly Museum and the Museum of Fine Arts. But it was the local artists who invested and went into the neighborhoods that people weren't in yet and put their studios and put their homes. And then, of course, my husband inherited and his administration inherited the decision that would be made on the St. Petersburg Pier. That had been an issue for many years. And if you look at the history, it's always been a very personal topic for people. It's an emotional topic. But the infrastructure wasn't good, and something needed to be done to what was currently, at that time, the pier, and it had been shut down by the former mayor because of that, and so until a decision was made. So the pier was opened, the brand-new St. Pete Pier was opened in 2020, and it was the culmination of work of so many people within the city and in the community that came together, and it's one of the jewels of the city because... It's for everyone. It's not the only, but it is one place in the city that is accessible to anyone and everyone, regardless of whether you want to spend money, whether you can spend money, whether you have children and families or you don't, or you can go there and have a fine meal. You can go there and rollerblade and take your kids to the splash fountains or the playground and
walk your dog. And there's just, it's a gathering spot. There's musicians, and that's just, you know, one of the greatest things that happen. You know, we just, St. Pete also welcomed new museums, which I think, again, you know, arts is such a big economic driver in a community, and I think that helped attract people to come here, and you know, some people who decided to stay. And I really just think the sense of community is, it, St. Pete became a more welcoming and equitable community in terms of who calls it home. I mean, we are in the month of Pride Month right now, so I think it's appropriate to mention that. You know, my husband was one of the only politicians 20 years ago when St. Pete had its first Pride celebration to welcome that to the city. And he's continued to do that, whether he was mayor or not. And he did it before he was mayor, when he had his law office. He worked with businesses, you know, in the LGBTQ plus community. And so, but St. Pete, it has one of the largest Pride celebrations in the Southeast, if not the United States. And there's a reason for that. People feel comfortable here. They feel safe. They feel welcomed. And if you've ever been to our Pride celebration, it's not just people of the LGBTQ plus community who are there. It's people from all walks of life and persuasions and sexual orientations and families of different kinds. And it's a beautiful thing.
It is. Well, St. Petersburg is a very welcoming place in many ways. And I know that when we had a few years ago, we had BoucherCon, the big mystery convention here for mystery mm-hmm. authors at the Vinoy Hotel. This is such a wonderful, really such a gem of St. Petersburg mm-hmm. To go to the Vinoy Hotel.
Yeah.
And
that's so historic as well.
Oh, it is. It is. It's so wonderful. Now, there are so many ups and downs. Of course, one of the things that happens here in Florida, and particularly our St. Petersburg Clearwater area, we have hurricanes. So there's a lot of times where, you know, the mayor is really, he's facing a lot of problems.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was constant. And, you know, sometimes they were problems, sometimes they were challenges, but it was all part of the job. And yes, when Hurricane Irma threatened in 2017, he was in the middle of his reelection campaign for mayor. And so all eyes were on him, not only in that facet, because we were expecting a Category 3 hurricane, which thankfully turned out to be a Category 1. But as far as a leader and how a leader gets his city or her city through,
and prepared
event such as that.
Yeah, and he got everybody prepared. I tell you, everybody was complimenting, your husband for the preparation that went on in St. Petersburg. I know, because people were, you know, always trying to find out, you know, where, what was happening, and I remember
right.
that. So for you, I know some people have talked about you having a political career. I don't know if you want to go that route, or perhaps you'll take the easier route and become a novelist. And you're a writer. I mean, you worked for the newspapers, so you obviously know how to write well.
Yeah, thank you.
And I would love to. I can easily imagine, with your family background. Tell us just quickly your family background. There are the Scullys and a few things like that people will recognize.
Well, my mother's parents came here in the 50s or late 40s from Pittsburgh. And my grandfather had a restaurant. He owned restaurants his whole life. And on 8th Street and Central Avenue now in St. Pete, he owned Scully's Pittsburgher. And my mom and her sister were the only kids at that time who lived downtown. I mean, people would now think it's cool to live downtown, but for them, growing up, it was awkward. But they grew up in the restaurant business. And, you know, I think sometimes a somewhat unconventional childhood, that's, you know, maybe considered unconventional in some ways, turns out to be, you know, shape you throughout your life. And so, you know, she mentioned that when we used to have parades, we always had the Festival of States and the holiday parades, you know, all the kids came to their house because they had had the best view living downtown. And so they continued to own restaurants throughout, you know, my grandfather's life until he retired. And then, you know, growing up, my parents worked in that industry a little bit. You know, my mom worked as a dental assistant during the day, and my dad was building his pet products business as well. But on the weekends, to be able to afford to send us to Catholic school, they worked at the restaurant. And my dad was a musician, played several instruments, could play by ear, and my mom would wait tables. So, you know, that's what they did, and that's what had me at my great aunt's house on the weekend, writing to the newspaper about how I wanted to visit Washington, D.C., because, you know, while they were working late nights, we stayed there on the weekends. And, you know, those are...
Well, you have a wealth, of history to draw upon. So wherever you decide, I think that once you... This happens to people. Once they see their words on paper, that's what I always talk about. It's just a joy, right?
Yeah.
It is a joy. And you're giving people...
It's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun. And now I think that as I'm reading that, I'm thinking, oh, she could either start sort of a political thriller. She could go cozy mystery and make it a St. Petersburg, because she has so much information here about St. Petersburg. And we have a couple of fine writers here, like Carol J. Perry, who sets her books here. Somewhere along the line, or you could do political thrillers. You know, you've got it all sort of right there in your head, and now you just have to put it down on paper.
Right.
Okay.
You've given me some food for thought. You know, you might have sparked a new challenge for me.
Well, I want you back here in a year, because I think you're delightful.
That'd be awesome.
Your book, Accidental First Lady on the Front Lines, is available online. Do you have a webpage or anything you want people to go to?
Sure, I have. It's KerryKreisman.com, KerryKreisman.com. I'm on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, at Instagram, Kerry.Kreisman.author, and then I'm on LinkedIn.
Okay, well, First Lady, I will call you First Lady, and you're going to be back here with your first novel. Let's give you a year. Okay, how about that?
All right.
Okay, so get to work, because you've got the perfect name, Kerry Kreisman. Oh. If I was going to make up a name, I'd make up that name. So you're going to be back, okay?
Thank you, Patsy.
Okay, bye-bye now. Okay, I only have a few minutes to say bye to my audience. Oh, wow. Anyway, isn't that nice? First Lady of St. Petersburg, Florida. Anyway, I have to say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. He probably got nervous because I kept talking to her. But, you know, you can't just hang up on a first lady. And Big Ed saluted me, and I saluted him, because I should have been a general. I wish I was a general. Or I should have been a politician. You know, now I'm so stupid. I was shy when I was young, but I should have been a politician. I've been great. Okay, everybody. Bye-bye now.